This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Two questions, but before that, Vayikra is the kind of sefer that really tests a person's maturity. It's the kind of sefer that, as a child, I remember was terribly boring. And we used to come to Vayikra, all you could wait was to get back to Bamidbar again. And even later on, in each sefer, you used to try and pick out a pasuk here and there, or a chazal, a rashi, one of the mefarshim that spoke about something interesting. But generally, korbanos and all these things, one just didn't have a clue of what was really going on. Oh, so I'm going to explain to you. And why, and as one gets older, one finds in fact this is by far the most exciting part of the whole Torah. There's no part of the Torah, if one can compare parts of the Torah, that can compare to Vayikra for excitement. But one has to know how to approach it. And I've always thought that Bereishis is the kind of sefer that would appeal to theologians. That's where they really base everything on is Bereishis, the origins of religion. Shemois is sociologist, the origins of a nation, how a nation formed, the effects of slavery on a nation. That's a person who has a sociological outlook to Torah enjoys Shemois. Bamidbar is for the philosophers. You've got concepts there, and Bilam, and all the Yom Tovim, and all the philosophy of Torah you find in Bamidbar. And Dvorim is for the artists. Dvorim is full, every word in Dvorim is incredibly rich art. So what's Vayikra? Vayikra is for the intellectual. You've got to be an intellectual to appreciate Vayikra. That's why I say it's a measure of maturity. If you're not an intellectual, Vayikra doesn't make much sense, because it's a sefer that deals in concepts. There's no story, there's no narrative, there are no images. It's plain one concept after another. The whole thing from beginning to end is concepts. And a man who's at home with concepts is at home in Vayikra, and a man who battles with concepts battles with Vayikra. And that's why we say that a child should learn Vayikra first, to answer your question, Stanley, because you teach him the concept. You teach a 5-year-old the concept of a chatos, a korban chatos, and a korban oilo, and a korban asham, and so on. And you teach him the dinim of the korban, how it's done, and what it represents, and why it has to be done in this particular way, and not that particular way, and what you do with the blood, and what you do with the kerev, and the klayos, and the chelev, and you go right through the whole thing. And he understands, he has clarity in the concepts. He knows what a korban chatos is. He knows there are 4 types of korban chatos. He knows there's an oilo, and he knows that a todo falls into the category of an oilo, and he knows that there's an asham, and he knows for what you bring an asham, and so on and so forth. It's all clear. And then when you've done all that, then you take him to the farm, and you say, that's a keves, and that's a poro, and that's a par, and that's an egel. And then he fits the reality into the concept, and he becomes an intellectual that way, and is able to handle it. But if you first say to him, that's a little poro, and it goes moo, and then later on you say, you know, the Torah says you've got to bring a korban, you've got to shech this poro, it hurts his, breaks his heart, and he can never really adjust to it. But take this nice little cow with which he's already established an identification separate from the Torah's identification, and then you say, now the Torah says you must kill this little animal. It's unfair to the child. If you're able to start and establish the relationship with the child is with a concept, the relationship is the korban, and this is what we use for a korban, totally different than is an intellectual. And we start with a child at the age of 5 training him to handle concepts, because if one can't handle concepts, one can't be a Talmid Chacham. It's the same as if you would teach a person, give him a trade first, or teach him his business first, and then tell him, oh, by the way, there's a din of Shabbos, everybody else works 7 days a week, you've got to do it all in 6 days a week. Very hard for him. But if you first tell him the dinim of Shabbos, and when he understands that and is absorbed and integrated with that, you say, now I'm going to teach you a trade for the 5 days of the 6 days of the week you're allowed to work. There's no conflict. It's not difficult for him not to work on Shabbos. Shabbos is where he starts from. Working is what you do the rest of the time. Depends where you start, and that's why we're at a tremendous disadvantage if we don't start right at the beginning the right way. It's not a disadvantage which can't be overcome. It can. It requires a bit of effort. But I always say the important thing is to see that it's not repeated with the next generation. That at least our kids are raised as Torah intellectuals. They're raised with being able from the earliest ages to be able to handle concepts of Torah, and they then see the reality as fitting into the Torah. That they're introduced to the world through Torah and not introduced to Torah through the world. But that's quite demanding. Shmini really is divided into two. It's up to Shishi and then from Shishi onwards. Up to Shishi deals with the korbanos that took place on the Yom HaShmini, on the eighth day after the putting up of the Beis HaMikdash, which was the day of the inauguration of the Mishkan. That's when the whole thing started, when the Kohanim started functioning as Kohanim, and the Mishkan started functioning as a Mishkan, and the Mizbeach started functioning. This was the day it all happened, and the up to Shishi is a chronicle of the first day, exactly what happened during that day. From Shishi we have some of the dinim of Kashrus, something else. There are two questions I want to ask. The one is a sort of a philosophical question emerging out of Monday's shiur, and the other is a question on the Pasha. We discussed on Monday that our relationship with the physical and spiritual world is, there are two types of relationship. The one is the relationship as defined by conceptualization, that is where we convert the various material aspects of the world into concepts, and we handle them in the Beis HaMikdash, we handle them as Torah, like we were discussing before. A cow is not a little cow that lives on a farm, or an ox is not an ox that lives on the farm. It's a power that can be brought for an oil, and it can be brought for certain korban chatoses, and so on and so forth. That's what one sees a power is. One conceptualizes it into the chetzer of a korban oil, and the chetzer of a korban chatos. That's what that thing is, that animal over there. It's not a cow, it's a power, and that power refers to in the Torah. It's a concept. It's the material embodiment of a concept. So we take our material things and we conceptualize them, we turn them into concepts, we spiritualize them. We take the material and we convert it into spirituality, which Einstein says can be done. There is also the opposite which can be done, that is taking the spiritual and materializing the spiritual. And that's the concept of Hishtalshulus, that's the concept of the whole world as we have it is actually the material, the materialization of various spiritual concepts that exist in the worlds above. And we discussed it in particularly in relationship to matzah, where we saw matzah as the concretization of a particular concept which we discussed. And then we said that the mitzvah in handling the matzah was eating it, which is a very unusual way to handle a chetzah shel mitzvah. We don't normally eat a chetzah shel mitzvah, but matzah, the mitzvah, the way we handle mitzvah is not to shake it like you shake a lulav, and not to tie it around your arm like you do with tefillin, but to eat it. That's how you handle the chetzah shel mitzvah. And we discussed whether there's something peculiar in halacha also about the way this is handled. In other words, is achilo, is eating, simply the way you handle a piece of matzah, the same as you put on tefillin or you shake it a little, or is this a completely different concept? And the Torah says, eat the chetzah shel mitzvah. That's a completely different concept. And we came out that it's a completely different concept. And that's why you've got to be hungry when you eat the matzah, and you've got to eat it because you want to eat, not because you're full. Whereas in other mitzvahs, if you have no physical benefit out of the mitzvah is still greater. And then when it comes to matzah and korban pesach and the various mitzvahs associated with achila, with eating, you've got to eat it properly with relish and with teyovin. You must enjoy it and you must taste it and you must it must satisfy you. You must be hungry for it. All that you've got to relate to it in all the physical ways that you would relate to any other food. So we see that this is very unusual. It's different to the normal handling of chetzah shel mitzvahs. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, we found that it's similar to other handlings of mitzvah in that we paskin that you need kavona even for the eating of matzah. You need intention. If it was something different where all you needed to do was consume this chetzah shel mitzvah, the matzah is now the concretization of a certain spiritual concept, and the Ribbono Shel Olam wants you to put that in your stomach and make it part of you. If that was the mitzvah, you shouldn't need kavona. It's just you're taking it in, and as long as you've absorbed it and you've eaten, what more do you need? What kavona do you need? When do I need kavona? When I take a material object and I create something spiritual out of that thing, then I need kavona, sure. If an artist takes a paintbrush and he takes his material paint and his canvas and he wants to create something on that canvas, he needs kavona. He can't just do it, just throw the paint all over the place. He needs kavona, he needs intention. He needs a specific design, a specific approach to his canvas. Otherwise it has no content, it has no art. So I understand with mitzvahs, I can't just take a lulav and shake it. If I want to use a lulav properly, I've got to have certain kavona. I've got to take the material, which is the lulav and the esrog, and I've got to take myself and I've got to combine in a particular way which is pointing in a certain direction. I've got to understand what I'm doing and know what I'm doing. That's how I understand with all the mitzvahs. But when it comes to achilo, then all I've got to do is eat. What do you need for that? What kavana do you need for that? And consequently, many of the Rishonim paskin that you don't need kavana for achila. It's not necessary to have any kind of intention when you eat. As long as you've eaten, it's gone down your throat, you've enjoyed it the way you enjoy any other food, the mitzvah's done. Didn't do it l'shem mitzvah, if you didn't do it for them in the name of a mitzvah, you didn't realize you were even doing a mitzvah, doesn't matter, the mitzvah's done, the mitzvah is to eat it, you've eaten it, that's it. Nothing artistic about eating, it's physiological. But we don't paskin that way. We paskin that you do need kavana, you do need to give it intention and to have the right approach to it, so that there is something artistic even in the eating. What is it? Is it like every other mitzvah, isn't it? There's something peculiar about the mitzvahs of eating which we have to understand. The next thing is, we're told in the parasha, at the end of chapter Yud, Va'et se'ira chatat darosh darash Moshe v'hinei sora. And the se'ira chatat, the goat that was brought for a chatat offering, now several korbanos were brought today. There was the egel hachatat of Aaron. There was the par as the oil for Aaron. Then the people brought a se'iri zim as a chatat, and the people brought a keves, I think it was, as an oil. That's already four. In addition to that, there was the chatat of Rosh Chodesh, which it was Rosh Chodesh Nisan that day, so every Rosh Chodesh the people in general bring a korban chatas, that's also Seirizim. And there was the korban of Nachshon ben Aminadav, who he was the Nossi, he was the prince who had the turn that particular day to bring his korban. Of those seven korbanos, three were Seirei chatas, three were goats: the korban chatat of the people, the korban of Nachshon ben Aminadav, and the korban chatat of Rosh Chodesh. Those three were goats. The korban chatat of Aaron was an eagle, it was a calf. So when it says ve'etzira chatat darosh darash Moshe v'yinei sorav, Moshe went around searching for the se'ira chatat, which of the three is it referring to? So the Gemara in Zevachim, Daf Kuf Aleph, works out that it can only be referring to the se'ir of Rosh Chodesh. It can only be referring to that se'ir, that goat which was brought by the people as a sin offering for Rosh Chodesh. Right? The other sin offerings, leave out Nachshon ben Aminadav, it doesn't fit into the picture. The sin offerings of Aaron and of the people for the Yom HaShmini, not for Rosh Chodesh, were not conventional sin offerings at all. We call those Kodshei HaYom, I think it's called, and not Kodshim L'doros. It was a peculiar requirement of the Ribbono Shel'olam for that particular day never to be repeated. That's it. On that Yom HaShmini, they each had to bring a Korban Chatas, but this wasn't a general thing. Whereas the Korban Chatas of Rosh Chodesh is one that is brought every single Rosh Chodesh, a Korban Chatas is brought. So the Gemara works out in Zvachim that when Moshe went looking around for the Korban Chatas, he was looking for the one which was brought for Rosh Chodesh, and that is an actual one to atone for sins. That's not one of these vague Korbanos that is brought by Aaron and by the people where we don't quite know exactly what its purpose is. This is a regular Korban Chatas which is brought for the Kapora, it's brought for the atonement of the people. And Moshe goes looking around to find where it is. It was brought a while ago, and everyone's gone berserk about the miso of the sons of Aaron. Sons of Aaron have died because they mishandled the korbanos, and they had to be taken out, and everyone's very upset. And Moshe realizes that in all this upset, he doesn't know what's happened to the seir, he doesn't know what's happened to the goat. The din is, with that kind of korban, or this, when a seir zim is brought as a korban chatos, the blood is not taken inside the heichal itself, and therefore it's eaten by the Kohanim. The Kohanim have to actually eat the korban, and he was worried that the Kohanim weren't eating the korban, so he turns around. So he gets angry with Elazar and Itamar, the two remaining sons of Aaron, and he says to them, "Why haven't you eaten the korban chatat? He finds it's been burnt, it was left on the fire, and it's burnt to a fragile." And he says, "What's going on? Why didn't you take it off and eat it?" And it is the eating, the Ribbono Shel'olam gave you the duty to eat that korban in order to remove the sin of the congregation, to atone for them in front of the Ribbono Shel'olam. You've just been messing around and the thing's been burning there. the blood was never brought inside the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Ochel Tzorich L'Rusol B'Kodesh Kasher Tzivisi. Go and eat it the way you, or you should have eaten it, the way I commanded you. Vayedaber Aaron El Moshe. So Aaron speaks up. The reason Moshe spoke to Elozar and Itamar and not to Aaron was Derech Eretz. He was angry, and he wasn't prepared to take the anger out on the Kohen Gadol. So he spoke in front of the Kohen Gadol to his two sons. So Aaron speaks. Vayedaber Aaron El Moshe. Hein hayom ikrivu et chatosam ve et oilosam lifnei Hashem. You know, it was only today that those two boys brought their chatos and oilo. That's the first one now. That's the one they brought because of the Yom Hashmini, because of the eighth day of the introduction of the services of the Beis HaMishkan, of the Mishkan. They brought their chatos and they brought their oilo lifnei Hashem in front of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Vatikrena oisi ko'ele, and such a tragedy happened to me. Vo'achalti chatas hayom, and I'm still going to eat a sin offering today. Hayitov b'enei Hashem, is that going to be good in the eyes of God? Vayishma Moshe vayitov b'enei. Moshe hears and he accepts it. What's going on here? The din is you eat it. What's Aaron making a new halacha here? Because I'm not feeling well. My son's died today. I'm not going to eat it. Where did he get it from? What did he base it? So I want to understand. The first thing is in the whole matzah discussion, I want to understand why you need kavona for the eating of matzah. And here I want to know, what did Aaron do wrong, or in what situation did Aaron find himself which made it impossible for him to eat the korban chatos? Neither he nor his sons to be able to eat the korban chatos. Now, to understand this, we have to look at the psychology of Aveiro a little bit. Korban chatos is brought for a shogeg. If one does an Aveiro by mistake, you bring a korban chatos. Let's see what makes one do an Aveiro. So I'll send the Yetzer Hara. Yetzer Hara is the guy we always blame for it. Yetzer Hara. Sure, it's the Yetzer Hara, but how does it work? The Yetzer Hara is that force which the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us that keeps us going. That's what the Yetzer Hara is. The Yetzer Hara is the basic animal dynamics of life. We have an inborn dynamics of animal existence. That which makes us want to live. That which makes it unacceptable for us to commit suicide. That which makes, not philosophically unacceptable, but physically unacceptable. I can't do it unless there's something wrong inside. That which makes it impossible for us, which makes it possible for us to sleep when we're tired. We then just get carried away and forget to sleep. We have an inborn dynamic that demands sleep at certain times, demands food at certain times, demands drink at certain times. The dynamics of the Yetzer Hara. Furthermore, it demands a certain security. It has many demands, and these demands can in fact run out of control. This is one of the things we're going to talk about. But the Gemara says basically, if it weren't for the Yetzer Hara, nobody would get married, nobody would build a home, nobody would go to work, nobody would earn a living, nobody would relate to one another really. People wouldn't want one another, need one another. The Yetzer Hara is the thing that keeps society going. The world couldn't exist without this inner animal drive that makes us want more and achieve more and drive us further to do all sorts of things. If it weren't for that Yetzer Hara, the whole thing would collapse. It just couldn't exist. That's the Yetzer Hara. So now what goes wrong? So the Yetzer Hara is a wonderful thing. Without the Yetzer Hara, we wouldn't survive. Not 2 days. We wouldn't drink, we wouldn't eat, we would get so carried away with our learning or with whatever we're doing that we would forget to do all the things we need to keep ourselves going. So the Yetzer Hara is a wonderful thing. The question I say, how does one come to do an Aveiro? Why do we blame this wonderful Yetzer Hara for our Aveiros? Well, two things can happen. The one thing that can happen is that the Yetzer Hara demands a steak when there are no kosher steaks available. That's the one kind of Aveiro. That means my body metabolism demands a steak. That's what it is. My mouth is watering, I need a steak. There's no kosher steak available. So you start working, maybe it's kosher. It's not that it's not kosher, it's just that you're not sure it's kosher, but it might be kosher. And you know, pikuach nefesh, who knows if I can even survive without it. I can get ill if I don't satisfy my needs, and work, and you have the kosher steak. The one level it works at, one doesn't have to take the example of eating a non-kosher steak. One can take much finer examples. But the Yetzer Hara needs to do certain things which are not quite 100% in accordance with halacha. That's it. You know, comes 3 days Yom Tov, you've got a Thursday, Friday, a Shabbos. The Yetzer Hara needs to take a bath. It's not that you don't need to take a bath. The Yetzer Hara needs to take a bath. It's that which is looking after your body. That force which is looking after your body needs to take a bath. There are ways you can do it halakhically, there are ways you can't do it halakhically. The Yetzer Hara wants to take the easiest way and the quickest and most efficient way. The Yetzer Hara is an outstanding businessman, efficient and competent, and doesn't like settling for any messing around. Time to take a bath and run the water and get in. You've got to start battling. It doesn't work like that. You can't just do it like that. But that's the way an Aveira could be committed. So you take it easy, and oh, taking a bath, it's the Rabbonah, it's Abed Doraisa, Yomtzeh, it's not Shabbos, and it's Lichvod Shabbos, because tomorrow's Shabbos, that's why I'm really doing it, and so it goes, and so it goes, and all of a sudden you find yourself in a situation of Aveira because your body's demanded it, your body dynamics have demanded it. But for that kind of Aveira, you can't bring a Korban Chatas. That's an Aveira, but maze it. You're deliberately doing an Aveira. That's not the area that we're dealing with in this Sedra, with the whole concept of a Korban Chatas. The concept of a Korban Chatas only comes for a different one, and that is where you have an Aveira that you don't know that the steak you're eating is not kosher. To bring a Korban Chatas. You thought it was kosher, you find out afterwards it's not. Well, that's not an onus. That's not a situation where you can say, oh, I didn't know. Okay, it's finished, the palin, that's it. Not my fault. But actually bring a Korban Chatas for that. That's what the Korban Chatas is for. Or, you didn't know that the laws of kosher extend to steak. That's it. Pork and all that, but a regular steak from an ox or from a cow, that you didn't know that was included in the laws of kosher. Those are the two kinds of averos which are covered by the Korban Chatas. Now what is it in the Korban Chatas? And what is it that's gone wrong then? How does one come to it? Why is that regarded as an avera? What have you done wrong there? You didn't know. So what? Couldn't help it. Goes even further, the Rambam paskens that a Korban Chatas even has to be brought by a Tinuk Shenishma Ben Ha'akel, a man who has had no opportunity of knowing. If you say we're talking about a man who should know better, you should have learned, I can understand. But a man who was born in a jail where there wasn't a single Jew and he had no access to a Jew. He was born on Robben Island and that's where he's lived all his life. And there's no way he could possibly know that you're not allowed to eat steak. Such a man also has to bring a Korban Chatas if he eats a trefa steak. Why? What's he done wrong? Look in Vayikra, where it says, "Daber b'nei Yisrael, speak to the children of Israel, lemor, saying, Nefesh ki techto bishgogo." This is now when the Torah introduces the concept of a Korban Chatas for a yochid, and where an individual has to bring a Korban Chatas. So the Torah, if a nefesh sins by mistake, a nefesh, soul sins, a nefesh sins by mistake. Ask the Ramban, why nefesh? Adam, up till now we've had the other three kinds of a chatas, and we've talked about how does the Torah put it here? No, sorry, this is the introduction to the whole concept of korban chatas. This is the beginning of Perek Dalet. Before they're categorized into four different korbanos, right in the beginning, nefesh ki techata bishagoga. Ask the Ramban, why nefesh? Says the Ramban, ba'avur heyot ha-machshava b'nefesh v'hi ha-shogeget. Because one's intellect is seated in one's nefesh. One's intellect is not really part of one's physical being. One's intellect is seated in the nefesh. It's not the neshama, it's the nefesh. Ve'hi ha-shogeget. And it's one's intellect that has made the mistake. I mean, you didn't know it was this. You didn't know that this meat was trade. It's an intellectual mistake. You should have known. We'll come on to how you should have known in a moment. You didn't know that there was a din about kashrus as far as steaks are concerned. It's an intellectual mistake. Had you learnt, you would have known. That's how this kind of Aveira arises. The first Aveira that we discussed is not an intellectual one. That's simply an Aveira that results from lack of character. God doesn't have the ability to stand up to himself even, never mind to others. Not even stand up to himself. That's the one kind of Aveira. This guy can stand up to himself. Had he known, it was awesome. He would never have done it. He simply didn't know. Didn't know that there was a din like this, although he knew there was such a din, he didn't know that this object falls into the classification of the din. It's an intellectual mistake. That's what you bring a chatas for an intellectual mistake. Why? What should the guy have done? He didn't know. You bring a korban chatas for not being on the level where you knew. That's what it is. You're bringing a korban chatas not for that one avera. It's a nefesh has made a shugoga. Not that you've done that avera, and for that avera you bring a chatas. That Aveiro demonstrates that the level on which you're operating is too low. You should be on a higher level. That's what it demonstrates. Demonstrates that you're operating on a basis where you could do such a thing. Had you known better, you would never have done it. But the fact that you don't know about it means that you're not on the level you should be. You should have known about it. What do we mean that you should? He's not punished. The Kobachadus is not a punishment. You can't punish such a man. What do you mean he should have known? He couldn't have known. He didn't know. He didn't have the opportunity. But a Korban Chatas is to correct the problem caused by operating on that lower intellectual level. Let's understand what the Korban Chatas does and what it is. He takes the Seir Izim. The Seir Izim is the fellow who represents our friend the Yetzer Hara. Right? The Seir is the hairy goat. Esav lived in Seir. We've discussed this before. The sa'ar, the hair, is the externalism of the human being, or of an animal. It's that which is most external. It's that which meets the eye, and that's the domain of the Yetzer Hara. He operates in Seir. He operates in the hair. That's where he is. And when we say that the Seir represents the Yetzer Hara, we're not talking about poetic imagery here. We're talking about the Seir is the Yetzer Hara. When you make the Seir this way, the same as when we talked about Matzah and Zerizus, we didn't say Matzah symbolizes Zerizus. We said that by making Matzah according to the recipe given in the Torah, Matzah is Zerizus. And when you're eating Matzah, it's not symbolic of a man eating Zerizus. You are, in fact, eating Zerizus at that moment. It's like I can say, if I'm lying on an operating table, Chas v'Sholom, and Professor Barnard has got my heart in his hand, and he breaks it, I'll die. He's broken my heart. Now what happens when I say I've given to somebody my love, I've given you my heart, I've given all my emotions to you, you're holding my heart in your hand, and that person can also break it? Am I talking about two different things? I'm not. I'm talking about the spiritual aspect and the physical aspect of the same thing, except Professor Barnard can hold it because it's material, whereas a beloved person can't hold that kind of a heart because it's not material, but it's the same heart. It's the heart. When we talk about a lathe, we're talking about that same heart that beats inside you. The one that beats inside you is the physical aspect of it, and it has spiritual. It can be spiritualized too. There is such a thing. The same as we had in those Midrashim. It was a precious stone. It was not representative of the Olam Haba of the particular individual concerned. It was the Olam Haba of that individual. That was it. It was concretized. And so the emotions that we call lathe, the emotions that we call heart, are concretized into this thing that towns inside us, but it's the same thing. So when we talk about the Seir as representing the Yetzer Hara, we're not talking about him representing the Yetzer Hara. That in fact is the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is a concept that by following the recipe, by following the specifications given by the Torah in Vayikra and Tzav, preparing a Seir Izim in that particular way and resting one's hands on it, doing a smicha on the Seir Izim, by doing all those things, that Seir Izim actually becomes one's Yetzer Hara. That is the physical manifestation of one's Yetzer Hara. What does one do with it then? One first of all takes a knife and one slits its throat. One shechts it. And it's not again symbolic of shechting your Yetzer Hara. At that moment, if you've put the right intentions and you've put the right qualities and the right things into this korban, when you take that knife and you slit its throat, you are slitting the throat of your Yetzer Hara. You're handling it in exactly the same way, in the same way as a person can die from a broken heart emotionally, and he can die from a broken heart physically, and it's the same heart which is broken, although in one way it's a material thing, in one way it's an emotional thing. Here, when you slit the throat of the Seir Izim, it's that same Yetzer Hara, it's your Yetzer Hara. We're not playing games with Korbanos. Korbanos is not symbolic representations of all sorts of things. This is the real thing. The Ribbono Shel Olam has given us an incredible gift, as he did with Matzah. He's given us an ability to concretize a concept such as the Yetzer Hara in such a way that one can handle it physically. It's very difficult to handle concepts spiritually. Very, very difficult. The Ribbono Shel Olam has enabled us to concretize them and in fact handle them physically before we re-spiritualize them again. And so the Seir Izim is the concretization of the Yetzer Hara, and we slit its throat. That's the mastery of the Yetzer Hara. Before we come to the next thing, let's see, what's the correct system of living? So one has to take the Yetzer Hara and one has to say, look, your job is to see that I have a house and to see that I have food and clothing and that I go to work in the mornings and I eat when I'm hungry and I don't eat when I'm hungry and I sleep when I'm tired. That's your job. Everything else you leave to me. All the decisions in this place, I take. All you've got to do is to see that my body carries on functioning. to leave me free to get on with the job of living. That's what one has to tell one's Yetzirah. Assuming one gets to that level where one actually has that kind of relationship with a guy, is that the level we're supposed to be on? One would think on the surface, yes, that's fantastic. Yet it's not so. So let's say he's built a house, and he's raised a family, and he's got a business, and the house has no atmosphere of Torah or whatever. There are no mezuzahs on the door, there are no sforim inside the house. There's no learning in the house, there's no haknas asochim in the house. He has a business and he doesn't give tzedakah. He eats, but what does he do with his strength? He goes to business and he sleeps and he eats and he goes to business and he eats and he sleeps. What's happened? Because there's no meaning in it. There's no value in it. So he's doing what's expected of him. The Yetzirah is functioning in the area that it's meant to function, but it's achieving nothing. What do we do with the Korban Chatos? Before that, just a step further here. The second type of Avera which we discussed, that is the Avera committed where you didn't know. The Avera is because you went on the level where you knew. Why weren't you on the level? Why wasn't a man, leaving aside the Rambam, why isn't a man on the level where he knows? It's not important enough to him. Why is it not important enough to him? Because he can manage without it. That's really what it is. Things you can't manage without, you've got. Nobody's living without water. Nobody's living without food. Nobody's living without sleep. The things that your Yetzirah needs, you've got. Anything that you need, you've got. So the knowledge that you need, you obviously don't consider that you need it. If you considered it really vital to have that knowledge, you would have it. That's the Avera. The fact that you're living in a life where the fact that your Yetzirah's needs are satisfied, satisfies you too. You have no needs beyond the needs of the Yetzirah. That is the essence of Torah primitivity. When we talk about a primitive man, that's what we mean. A man who, when his Yetzirah needs are satisfied, he's satisfied. That's a primitive man. A sophisticated man in Torah, his Yetzirah needs, that's he doesn't even know about them. The Yetzirah looks after them. He's busy making sure that his neshama, that his spiritual needs are looked after. And when we talk to him, we say, how could you eat that steak? He says, you know, just didn't know it wasn't kosher. We say, you know, if it was important to you, You found the steak, alright. You knew where to find the steak. Why? Because your Yetzirah needed it. If it was important to you to know what kind of a steak it was, you would have found out. You would have checked up. Just wasn't important enough to you. As long as your Yetzirah was being fed, that's all you needed. When your Yetzirah needs are satisfied, your needs are satisfied, you've got to bring a Korban Chatos. What do we do with this Korban Chatos after it's shechted? We shecht it to show that the Yetzirah has no life dynamics of its own, of any value really. The Yetzirah really has value as meat. It's there to serve something higher. It's there to be used for something greater. We take the seerism and we deprive it of its life because its life has no value as such. Its life only has value in as much as it serves human beings. That's what animals have been put in the world for the role they can play in serving people. And then we take that seer after it's been shechted and we cook it on the mizbeach and the Kohen eats it. It's exactly what we do. How does that work? And the Gemara then tells us, as if by magic, Kohanim oichlim v'balim mitkapim. The Kohen eats and the owner is atoned. Like that. Magic. Everything else that's gone on, all the preparation, the tefillah, the davening, the smicho, the shchito, the whole business. The owner still has the avera on his shoulders. Comes the achilo, the Kohen puts it into his mouth, at that moment he's got no averas on his shoulder. What happened? How does it work? What's the magic? The whole Aveira came about because the Yetzirah was not fulfilling any greater purpose, was not being used for anything higher. When you take that same Yetzirah and it's used, a Kohen uses it to give him strength, to nourish himself, you're reversing the whole cause of what brought him to the Aveira in the first place. You're taking, remember, the Yetzirah itself, not a representation of the Yetzirah, but the Yetzirah itself, and you're feeding a Kohen with it. That's a Korban, it's a seir which was bought with money which was earned by the Yetzirah. It would otherwise have been eaten to feed the Yetzirah. This is Yetzirah material. It's a seir. It's lent on. The kavanah, the intention is that this should be my Yetzirah. The Torah tells us that works. This is in fact your Yetzirah. We submit it and we feed it to the Kohen. At that moment when the Yetzirah lands up being used by a Kohen who's worthy, you've got something incredible. There the Yetzirah lands up fulfilling its purpose. The only requirement is that the Kohen obviously is on a very high stature. Doesn't help to feed a nobody with a meat. So you're using your Yetzer Hara again, you're just going around in circles. You've shechted your seer, fine, very nice, and you have a guy who's technically a Kohen, but he's not really anyone particularly great or special. So your Yetzer Hara is feeding him. Who needs him around? What's he doing? Well, what are you achieving by feeding him? You're feeding a Kohen, you're nourishing a Kohen, a man of stature, a man of learning, a man of tzitzis, a man of leadership, and your Yetzer Hara is giving him the strength to carry on his work today. That's fantastic. That's a reversal of the whole procedure. But if he's Tamar Kohen who lies around all day and doesn't do very much with himself, in any case, what's your Yetzer Hara giving him the strength to do? To carry on doing nothing. Who needs that? It doesn't work. It's not functioning. Says Aaron to Moshe, while we were in the middle of initiating our priestly service, our kahuna, they died. So it can't be because they were tzaddikim, or because they'd fulfilled their purpose already on this world, or because their time had come in any case. The Moshe doesn't take you in the middle of doing a mitzvah. There must have been something wrong with the mitzvah. That means we're not kohanim yet. I'm going to eat a korban chatas on which the atonement of the people depends. That's their Yetzer Hara they've put in my hands. And they said, Aaron, eat it, because when you eat our Yetzer Hara and that gives you strength, then we'll know that our Yetzer Hara is fulfilling a purposeful purpose. That our Yetzer Hara is in fact achieving something in the world. Says Aaron, me? After this has happened to me, I'm going to eat that korban and let them think that they've had atonement. Let them rather know the fact they haven't. If this withholds kapora, if this is going to withhold the atonement, rather let them know the fact they don't have atonement. I'm not going to cheat them. Vayishma Moshe vayitav beino. Moshe hears and he's satisfied with it. That answers the second question. What it is that Aaron had that he felt made it impossible for him to eat the korban. And that reason is given by the Rashbam. That's how the Rashbam learns Aaron's answer. The Sipurna learns it slightly differently. Sipurna says the following: Hayitav be'enei Hashem shenoichal kodshei doiros ba'aninus. Do you think it will be good in the eyes of Hashem that as oinanim, that means the funeral has not yet taken place, I've got two dead sons lying around that have not yet been buried. In that situation, would it be good in God's eyes that I eat the kodshim, that I eat the korban? Halodo v'yaduahu, surely it is well known, She'ein achilas oinein bekavono ru'uyo lechaper, that the eating of an oinein is not with sufficient kavono to have kapora, to have atonement. So we see that there's another requirement here. The first requirement is that you're a man of stature. According to the Rashbam, Aaron felt that there was something lacking in his stature to make it really worthwhile. Because the whole thing depends on the stature. If the man is really a man of stature and is nourished by your Yetzer Hara, then you've contributed to his stature. That justifies the existence of your Yetzer Hara. That's fine. But according to the Sipurna, we see there's another element here. There's the element of kavona. You can't just eat. When you're trying to do this, when you're trying to raise the thing you're eating, when you're trying to raise the world you're handling by the way you're handling it, that can't be done just so. That needs kavona. You've got to know that's an art. Because you're taking something physical and you're changing it. By your eating it, you're relating to it in a special way, and you're giving it purpose, you're giving it value. That's what you really do. You're giving it value. What is an artist doing when he paints? He takes a mishmash of colors and a blank canvas and he gives it value. He puts neshama into something dry. He puts spirit, he puts feeling, he puts a value, he puts a concept into something dry. For that you need kavanah. And as we started off saying, for those mitzvahs where that's what you're doing, you're taking raw material and you're doing something to the raw material to give it value and purpose. You're creating a mitzvah out of the raw material. That, I understand, you need kavona for. That a situation of achilo, do you need kavona? When you're eating, do you need kavona? According to the Sipurna, it depends why you're eating. If you're eating just to fill your stomach, you don't need kavona. That's not artistic. That's a normal animal. That's a Yetzer Hara function, just to eat to fill your stomach. But if one of the purposes of your eating is to raise the thing you're eating, to give purpose and value to what you're eating, then you do need kavona. Then you need particular attention to what you're doing. And that explains, in the case of the matzah, one's doing two things. Number one, one's eating the matzah as we explained on Monday. But number two, you're giving that matzah, you're raising that matzah. Since that matzah is now giving you strength, is now nourishing you, you're actually raising the matzah onto a different madrega. You're actually affecting the matzah. It's very interesting because you remember our whole concept of gavra and chetzer, the whole concept of imposing yourself on the world, handling material objects around you, or being handled by material objects. What is achila? Who's the gavra, who's the chetzer? When you're eating, who's the gavra and who's the chetzer? Are you imposing something on the food, or are you at the hands of the food? Very contradictory. On the surface, you take the food and you say a bracha on it, and you've prepared it in a particular way, and you behave yourself in a certain way while you're eating, and you put it into your mouth with all sorts of kavanas. You're a gavra. On the other hand, the moment it's gone through your mouth, you're a chetzer. Starts doing all things to your body, starts bringing about all sorts of secretments of all different substances from your body over which you have no control. And it finds itself being digested in your body, and it goes right through your body, through all the passages of your body. You have no control over it. So you're a chetzer all of a sudden. So eating is one of these things. That's why halacha is so careful and specific about the dinim of how you eat, because it's so dangerous. If you handle it wrong, it can ruin you. If you handle it right, it can make you. Achilo, eating is the holiest of things. It's korbonos, it's kodshei kadoshim. It's the holiest of holy things that we have in the whole Torah, revolve around eating. And some of the most severe yisurim revolve around eating. It's the most animal thing. Every animal, every form of life eats. So it's at both ends of the scale. It's the highest of the high and it's the lowest of the low. You're gavra and you're chetzer. So what does one need? One needs the concepts we discussed on Monday, in the sense that you're chetzer, that you need also to be a bit of an artist when you eat. You need to give a certain value. You need to give certain substance to the food you're eating. And for that you need kavana. So we pass them. That A, you've got to be hungry and you've got to treat it as regular food which is going to be digested and integrated and is going to contribute to your body system. That's the one requirement when you eat a chetzer shel mitzvah that needs to be eaten, such as matzah or a korban. The other is, you need kavon. You need intention. You've got to put in the right intention into it. I just want to end off by understanding the application of all this. And that is, that Aaron, before that, this Yetzer Hora business, how does one avoid being a person who, as long as the Yetzer Hora's needs are being satisfied, is satisfied and doesn't, has no needs beyond that, no urgent needs beyond that? Now, when I always tell you that one can tell by a person's face how he's learning, what do we mean? Because you can tell by a person's face whether his needs are being satisfied, number one. So when you see a certain complacent, dull look in a person's face, you know his needs are being satisfied. If his needs are being satisfied, he's not operating in a spiritual level at all. Because in a spiritual level, your needs are never being satisfied. That's the fantastic thing about operating in a spiritual level. You're always busy achieving. That's the one thing. The other thing is one can see what his needs are. Does he have physical needs, or does he have that look in his face where he's looking for something far beyond physical needs? Physical needs he's not worried about. He's looking for something bigger. And you see that search in his face. You see that intensity in his face. Then you know the guy's operating on a spiritual level. When you see him sort of dull look, you know, half dozing, whatever he does, and even when he's awake, it's you know, you don't see that search, you don't see that intensity of perception and vision and searching. You know you're a guy who's operating on the Yetzer Hara level, but how do you get out of it? How do you get to the point where you lie awake at night? Not because you don't have a home, Baruch Hashem, you've got a lovely home. Not because you don't have a parnasa, Baruch Hashem, you've got a balance in your bank, and you've got a few thousand stuck away, and your shares are doing well, everything's fine. Not because you've got trouble with your wife, Baruch Hashem, you're happily married, raising a nice family, everything going well. You've got no needs. How do you train yourself, how do you get to the level where you still lie awake, because you didn't understand the Tosfos? Because there was a shoe that doesn't quite integrate, doesn't quite fit. Because there's a halacha which you don't quite understand. You made a mistake today. You did something and you turned out afterwards it was wrong. How could you have done that? How does one get to the level that that's what keeps one lying awake? And in fact, adarabo, the fact that when on the contrary the bank is balance isn't so good and the bank's writing because of the overdraft and you've had a bit of a quarrel with your wife and the roof is leaking over your head, it still doesn't keep you awake. What you lie awake worrying about is still the same process. How do you achieve it? What do you do? These are two different people we're talking about. These are two different brias, like you talk about an ape and you talk about a man, lahavdil. They're two different things, and even if we'll accept Darwin's theory, the one comes from the other, okay, the one developed into the other, okay, but they're different, worlds apart, there's no comparison, you can't even talk about them in the same breath. So it is We'll accept evolution and we'll say that a man who operates on the Yetzirah level can become a Talmid Chacham, he can evolve into a Talmid Chacham. But until that happens, you can't say this is a man and that's a man. He's a better man, or he's a cleverer man, or he's on the spiritual level and this one isn't. It's not the same, just you're not talking about the same thing at all. That's a man and that's a Talmid Chacham. That's something else altogether. Two different concepts. How do you get there? When the Yetzer Hara is not serving a higher purpose. In other words, so the Yetzer Hara has got you your house. Now comes the question as to what do you enjoy? You make a fire. What do you enjoy? The wood or the fire? And you remember. If you remember, you were in the cold, you were lost in a forest, in the freezing cold, it was snowing, and you managed to find some wood and make a fire. What do you remember afterwards? The wood or the fire? The fire, that warmth that came. You've forgotten about the wood. The wood's not important. You only use the wood to make the fire. And if you had a group of people around the fire, it was like Bohemer, and you had a whole thing going, and you had a picnic there, and a braai, and you sang zmiris, and you danced, and there was a fantastic atmosphere. What do you remember then? You don't even remember the fire. You remember that which the fire contributed to make. So now you're two steps away from the wood. The wood, certainly you don't remember. Even the fire is vague at the back of your mind. What you remember is the emotional warmth of the whole thing. Now it works the same with the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara has built your house. What do you enjoy? What do you relate to? The house? The stones? What do you relate to? Or the atmosphere that that house enables you to build? The Yetzer Hara has got you your food. You're sitting at the table that's in front of you. The Yetzer Hara drove you out early yesterday to go and work. Made you work like a slave, made you stay at your office until 9 o'clock at night. Only a Meshuggah Yetzer Hara could make anybody do that, and it did it. So you got your salary at the end of the month, and you've got your food in front of you on the table. What do you relate to now? The food? Or is the food just a means of serving something greater? That's what the Korban Chatas comes to teach you. The way you have to relate is to take that little goat by the beard and shecht it and give it to the Kohen Gadol, to the Kohen, and you've got to be that Kohen. You only have to substitute that coin when you've failed to be the coin yourself. Then you've got to call in outside help. And you've got to say, coin, the only way I can get my Yetzer Hara to you is by concretizing it. I've got to make it into a seir, which I hereby do. And now you eat it. I have failed. It didn't work with me. When I ate it, it didn't help. Now you eat it. So you call in outside help. That's okay. But when that isn't happening, the normal run of events shouldn't be that at all. You're the coin. That means the Yetzer Hara is operating, and you're utilizing that for value. You're utilizing that for spirituality. That's when one's operating on the level that one doesn't need a korban chatos, i.e. that means one's operating on a level where one's not doing averus. That's it. Can't stop yourself by doing averus by saying, I must not do that averus, I must never do that averus again. It doesn't help. You've got to raise a level. If you're doing those averus, it means because that's the level on which you're operating. And the only way you can do tshuva is by raising the whole level up. And that means work and work and work. What kind of work? Spiritualizing, that's all. Stop getting pleasure from the physical. When you've got the physical in front of you, relate to the spiritual of it. Relate to the fire, not the wood. What is it that brings about the Yetzer Hara is when you're relating to the wood. You dance around the wood, you don't even like the fire. You couldn't even care about it. But the wood! And you know that wood can be converted into fire, and you'd sing and you dance around the wood. There it is, a stack of wood. Anybody looking at that would say you're a Meshuggah. Yeah, we're doing that all the time. We've got the food in front of us, which the Yetzer Hara has provided, and we relate to the food. That's it. We've now arrived. The house. The money. Whatever it is. And it works like that in Torah as well. I mean right inside Torah. The same way as in the world in general, one has the Yetzer Hara, the seir, the hair, the outside, the external. So in Torah itself, because the whole Torah existence looks like an onion. As you peel off the outside skin, you're left with another outside skin. And you peel off the outside, there's always an outside and an inside. And in Torah, there's also the outside and the inside. There is the chitzonius, there is the external manifestation of the things one's doing, and there is the panimius, there's the internal manifestation. Now one needs the external manifestation, and I'll explain why and how in a moment. But what one has to be very careful of is the following. I'll put it to you this way. One can use externalism for one of three things. It's either an expression of the internal. So you feel happy, so you sing. Singing is external. Singing is for the world. But you feel so happy that you sing, that's one way that chitzonius, that externalism, comes into being. It's born out of your inside. Fine. The other way is you don't feel happy at all. You feel downright miserable. But you also sing, because you think that by singing it will make you happy. And it works. So you're utilizing chitzonius, you're utilizing externalism to affect you internally. That's the second way one can use chitzonius. The third way one can use chitzonius is as a substitution for pnimius, as a substitution for internalism. There is no internalism, so at least let me have the externalism. How does that function? We've discussed often, a tzaddik can eat a little piece of bread and feel satisfied after that. Tasted good, it feels good, he's satisfied, he's had a meal, little piece of bread, it's quality. What he's put into that piece of bread, the piece of bread is put back into him. He's satisfied with it. A rosha, got to have a big steak and bread before, and a soup before, and then a main course, and he's got to have a big plate of chips, and he's got to have a dessert, and then he's got to have coffee and cake afterwards, and a cigar and a liqueur, and then maybe he feels satisfied. No? How do you know? What's the quantity? Where does that quantity come from? Why is the quantity needed? It's a substitution. When there isn't the quality, you need the quantity. That's how it is. And in Torah too, one has to be careful that you're relating to the fire, not to the wood. You've got to understand, you know, a man can walk into shul with his lulav and esrog, and somebody can say to him, "My, is that a beautiful lulav? Feels good." Why does he feel good? Because he needs it never. If nobody would have said that's a beautiful lulav, he wouldn't have felt it was a beautiful lulav. Because how would he know? He picked up a lulav. Now somebody said it's a beautiful lulav. He really feels good. He's busy davening and he overhears somebody say, "That guy davening, eh? Just watch him. Now he feels his davening. Now he feels frum." Why? Because he didn't feel frum before. If you feel frum before, if you feel your davening before, that can only disturb you. You can only feel intruded on. What's it his business to comment on my davening? What's it his business to comment about my lulav? You feel intruded on. This is my personal property. Something very, very dear to me. And it's not, in fact, for the outside world to see at all. It's got nothing to do with it. It's mine. This is my mitzvah. And I don't, and it's got nothing between me and the Ribbono Shel'olam. What's he sticking his nose into? And that's how you judge which way you're using the chitzonius. So you sing because you're happy. You're really happy, so you sing. And somebody walks past and says, ooh, nice voice you've got, eh? You're back to your depression again. It hasn't worked. He's wrecked it for you. Because it's something, your singing was very special to you. You were singing to let out a very, very special feeling, and he took that feeling and threw it out. It's got nothing to do with him. When you want to sing in such a way, you should lock yourself away and keep yourself away from people, because they spoil it. And if one's using chitzonius the other way, one's trying to affect one's internalism, and you're concentrating and you're singing to try and get yourself going, and somebody says, "Mark, nice voice you've got, hey?" Same thing. He's intruded into a very, very personal process which you've set in motion, and it disturbs you. But if you're using chitzonius as a substitution for pnimius, you don't have any internalism, all you've got is the externalism. He comes along and says, "Phew, nice voice, huh? Do you feel good? Ah, is that nice?" And when you're using your lulav because you don't have anything and you're shaking it around, that everybody should see you shaking it around, and your tefillin are the biggest they can possibly be, not because you went into it and that's what you need, but the people should say, "Let's see those tefillin." And somebody said, "Let's see those tefillin." If you're using your chitzonius as an expression of your pnimius, okay, you show the person the tefillin, it's no secret. But you feel a little bit, it's really none of his business. Tefillin is very personal property. Nobody comes and asks to see your personal things. Things that are none of their business, things that are just between you and your wife, things that are between you and your children, things that are for your immediate internal friends. Nobody intrudes and says, "Let me see." And if they do, you feel upset, you feel hurt. Yet me and the Ribbono Shel Olam, of which there's no more personal and intimate relationship than that, "Hey, you want to see? Yeah, aren't they nice? Look big. I paid $500 for them. Got them in such and such a place. A guy with a long beard sold them to me. If you want to know where, I can tell you the address." A lot of pride. That's not pride in the mitzvah. That's pride in the chitzonius. And one has to understand that as long as there's no value, as long as one's not deriving the spiritual value out of the mitzvahs or the materialism or whatever it is one's doing, if one's deriving one's pleasure from the physical aspect of it, then you're operating on the yetzirah level. Then you just need more and more of it. Then quantity is all you need. The more you've got to show, the more you'll have. In halacha, we have this concept too. The whole dispute as to whether you can wear a watch on Shabbos or not. What is it? The question is, definition of a watch. Why do you wear it in the first place? There's such a thing as a tachshit. The purpose of a tachshit is decoration. If a watch is decoration, you're allowed to wear it on Shabbos, because the din is that you're allowed to wear clothing and you're allowed to wear decoration, jewelry. But if the watch has its own purpose, in other words you're using it to tell the time, and it's simply on your wrist because that's the most convenient place to have it, because your hand is the easiest thing to look at, and if it was on the finger it would be too small, so the next best place to put it is on your wrist, and once it's on your wrist you might as well make it look nice. If that's what a watch is, you can't wear it on Shabbos. It's as simple as that. What's the whole discussion? You know, there's two kinds of art. There's decorative art and there's art. Decorative art I put on the walls. If somebody comes in and says, phew, that's a nice painting, I say, yes, isn't it? Doesn't it make the room look good? Fantastic. But if I've really got a piece of art, if I've really got something that I love, if I hang it on a wall, I hang it on a wall where people don't come in. They won't understand it, they won't appreciate it, I don't want them to intrude into it. The relationship that I have with that piece of art is something very special. It's not there to decorate my wall at all. It's there because of a very personal relationship I have with it, and it's nobody else's business. And I'll put it away somewhere. I'll either keep it in a cupboard, or if I do hang it up, it'll be in a room where people don't come in and out. It's not a tachshit. Same, if a watch is not a tachshit, you can't wear it on Shabbos. If a thing is not a tachshit, if it's not for decoration, you don't flaunt it. If a thing is for decoration, you flaunt it. Now when a man starts flaunting his mitzvahs, when a man starts flaunting his frumkeit, he's using his frumkeit for decoration. That's it. He's using it to decorate him. Same with the picture to make my room look nicely. The frumkeit is to make me look nice. And that's not Yiddishkeit. That's not value. The value is when I feel confident in how I am, and I'm using the chitzonius to draw more and more and to get more and more involvement, and it's part of my personal relationship with the Ribono Shel. That's the relationship I have, then it's completely different. And now you understand even better Aaron's comments to Moshe. And he says, Heina yom ikrivu et chatatam v'toratam lifnei Hashem. Today my sons brought their korbanos to the Ribono Shel Olam. Everything they did was right. The Chazal go into long discussions as to what in fact was wrong with that korban. And they say it was gaiva, and they didn't ask Moshe a shayla, and they pastened in front of Moshe. All sorts of reasons. Flaws in their character. But not flaws in how they brought the korban. The korban was brought correctly. The mitzvah was done in all its halachic requirements. Yet they were killed. Unlike Cain's korban. Cain's korban was also rejected. But why? There was something wrong in the chefta. There was something wrong with the object. He didn't bring the best. But in this case, the korban was rejected, although the korban was perfect. There was nothing wrong with the korban. Only one thing. The people who brought it weren't on the level. There was a qualitative lack in the people who brought it. Says Aaron, in that case, V'acharti chatot hayom, I'm going to eat this korban chatos. I can fool the people. They all think I'm a big tzaddik, no problem. I can eat the korban and they're all going to think they had a kapora. The korban's been brought according to halacha. I don't expect that the Ribono Shel Olam is going to kill me for it. But hayitav b'enei Hashem, is that really what makes the Ribono Shel Olam happy? That I, who am not on the level to eat of that korban because of an internal reason, should just do it for the sake of adornment. It's part of my job and it's part of my duty and that's what I'm meant to do. For that I must do it. When I know that I'm not on the level and I know I can't have the right kavana, is that hayitav b'enei Hashem? And Moshe accepts that. And he understands that the performance of a mitzvah does not only depend on the perfection of the object one's using, but it's one's ability to create and to draw value, to draw spirituality from the use of that object. And in the state of mind in which Aaron was, he wasn't on the level, nor was he, did he have the ability to concentrate sufficiently to put into that mitzvah that which was required.